Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up today, when musicians and artists draw inspiration from Saint Francis. Marking the anniversary of the death of Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta. And our popular Latin lover speaks to us of the gods the Romans believed in. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. As Pope Francis is about to make his way to Assisi on the 4th of October to mark the feast day of St. Francis, I'd like to bring you the next in a series of programmes focusing on this popular saint. After focusing on his story, his writings, and having spoken of the Franciscan charism, what I'd like to do now is draw inspiration from the works of musicians and artists, beginning with some musical notes from an opera dedicated to this popular saint. For this, we join Monsignor Philip Whitmore.
We've just been listening to a modern opera by the great French composer Olivier Messiaen. It was written in 1983, when the composer was 75 years old. Messiaen was a man of deep faith, and it came as no surprise that he chose a religious subject for this, his first and only opera. It's about St. Francis of Assisi. That was St. Francis himself, leading the friars in morning prayer. He's singing a passage from one of his most famous prayers, the Canticle of the Sun.
All praise be yours, my Lord, through all that you have made, and first my Lord, brother Sun, who brings the day, through whom you give us light. All praise be yours, my Lord, through sister Moon and stars. In the heavens you have made them bright, precious and fair. All praise be yours, my Lord, through brothers wind and air, both fair and stormy, all the weather's moods, by which you cherish all that you have made. All praise be yours, my Lord, through sister water, so useful, humble, precious, and pure.
St. Francis's love of creatures, especially animals, has inspired many artists and musicians over the centuries. Some of you may know the lovely fresco by Giotto of St. Francis feeding the birds. Rather less well known is a short piano piece by the 19th century Hungarian composer Franz Liszt. It paints a picture in sound of St. Francis preaching to the birds. As you can hear, the birds are still quite excited at this point, but later in the piece they calm down and pay a bit more attention to the saintly preacher. St. Francis has inspired hymn writers too. His Canticle of the Sun is the basis of a popular hymn. All creatures of our God and King, lift up your voice and with us sing, O praise him, Alleluia. The tune is a German chorale, Lasst uns erfreuen, written in Cologne early in the 17th century. The original words were addressed to Our Lady, rejoicing that her sorrows had been banished by the resurrection of her son. That's why there are so many Alleluias. The tune has spread to many different countries, and new texts have been supplied not only in English, but in Italian, in Portuguese, and in other languages too. It was a truly inspired choice by the country clergyman William Draper to make an adaptation of St. Francis's Canticle of the Sun to be sung to this tune. Those ringing Alleluias perfectly match the joyful spirit of praise pouring forth from sun and stars, earth and seas, and from every creature of our God and King.
Monsignor Philip Whittemore is a music historian, currently rector of the Venerable English College here in Rome. Our thanks go to him. And now, as promised, I'd like to help you imagine an artistic masterpiece depicting St. Francis receiving the stigmata. Stay tuned as we join Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, in one of Rome's churches.
Breda, we're sitting on a bench facing a picture. This church is called Santissima Stimmate di San Francesco, which is obviously St. Francis, and St. Francis linked to the Holy Stigmata. This church is the headquarters of the Archconfraternity of the Stigmata, which was founded in the late 1500s.
Because this is probably one of the strangest mysteries for people to understand. It's difficult to understand the stigmata. In all of Christian history, there are about 330 cases, 60 of whom have become saints or blessed, and the majority, strangely enough, of the people who received the stigmata were women, which surprised me when I read this detail.
But today we're actually going to speak about a man,
yes,
who received the stigmata, St. Francis, as we mentioned.
Yes.
There's a painting above the main altar, a huge painting, which takes up the entire wall, of St. Francis receiving the stigmata. It's an oil painting. It's very dramatic. St. Francis is there with his arms wide open, and there's some little cherubs up in the sky.
Yes, because for us, when we think about the stigmata, we think immediately of St. Francis. And here you have St. Francis in this marvellous 5 meters high painting of Francesco Trevisani, who you can see from the painting was trained by Venetian painters because of his way of using light.
Just to place the picture in time, we're talking 1700s, no?
Yes, 1719, in fact. But what's strange here, if you look at St. Francis is kneeling on the top of the mountain.
St. Francis received the stigmata in La Verna.
On the hill.
On the hilltop in La Verna.
Yes. With his hands wide out and his head back, he looks like he's put himself almost in the shape of a cross. And he has two companions with him. And the companion on the right is sitting quietly reading in an area which is totally calm and tranquil. The monk,
he's a hooded character.
Yes, yeah, with the Capuchin Franciscan hood. And then the monk on the other side is turning away almost terrified because of what's happening behind him. And Francis is looking up into the clouds, which have suddenly broken open like an explosion of energy and light, which is in total contrast to the sky on the right-hand side of the painting. So on the left of the painting, in the high point, you have all this gold and yellow and white and groups of angels protecting the exit from this area of energy, and a cherubim also leading the light and the rays out from the back, which is obviously coming from the Holy Ghost. And painted red, as you see this cherub, then rays come down they're a little bit faded now because of the painting. The private painting probably needs a bit of restoration. Coming right towards St. Francis, and he has his hands wide open as if he's ready to receive the wounds.
He hasn't got the wounds in it.
Not yet, no. And then if you look on the left-hand side, what's curious about this is you have a cross, a long, thin cross, a Latin cross, slightly bent backwards, in the same way that Francis himself is bent backwards on the right. So you have this, like, double energy on each side, like a catapult. You feel that if the cross just lets go, it's going to hit Francis like a rocket. It's a strange, marvellous way of painting energy. It's one of the few, let's say, of painting the cross and a situation like this. If you look at St. Catherine of Siena when she received her invisible stigmata, the cross bends forward towards her. Here you have the opposite. You have the cross bending backwards, Francis bending backwards. Between them, this mass of energy and light, and you know that it's all going to hit at a certain moment. So you feel the incredible tension. And the rest of the painting, the colours are essentially all variations on browns, and his use of pale, vaporous light, but the colours are clean. So you just feel like you're part of the moment when this incredible spiritual energy hits Francis, comes from the cross, and comes out of the sky. It's almost like a sense of the Trinity in the way the painting itself is painted. You have the cross, Francis, and the celestial, and the rays of energy, and let's say the moment of the great miracle coming out of the sky.
And you were listening there to Professor Breda Ennis, who is currently teaching fine arts at the American University of Rome. Meanwhile, as the United Nations dedicates the 5th of September, International Day of Charity, by recalling the anniversary of the death of Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta, I'd like to bring you an interview with Monsignor Leo Marsberg, author of Mother Teresa of Calcutta, A Personal Portrait, 50 Inspiring Stories Never Told Before, a book published by Ignatius Press.
We know very little about her. We know her social activities. We don't know her spiritual depth, and we know little about the night of her soul. It will be interesting if we manage to convey to the world a little more about who she really was, that she was not only a social activist, but she was a real simple saint.
You're talking about the dark night of the soul, which goes back to St. John of the Cross, I believe. But you also say in the introduction to your book that she was a reluctant public figure.
Yes, she was a media star against her will. She never wanted to be a media star. At the beginning, if you look at the Malcolm Muggeridge film, the first Malcolm Muggeridge film, you see a shy person squeezed to the wall with a body language which would tell you that she really didn't want to do that interview. And if you compare that with Mother Teresa in the 80s, 90s, she would joke with the media. She would tell the photographers, please stop now because purgatory is empty. That was her agreement with the Lord, that for every picture taken by her, one soul would go from purgatory to paradise. She would say, no, that's enough. Purgatory is empty. So she was learning. She was a star learning, and she became accustomed to the modern media.
Tell me a little bit more about the dark night of the soul you mentioned earlier.
Well, there's this book about it, which documents the whole story of that dark night of the soul, but we don't know what does it mean in our faith, in the Catholic faith. Why is it the dark night of the soul? If we follow St. John of the Cross, he wrote extensively about that, but it was a pastoral writing. It was his pastoral writing. He said, I need that for the souls I accompany pastorally because they go through the night of the soul. Night of the soul is the point when God allows you not to understand anything anymore because we cannot understand God. We simply cannot. We can be guided towards God, but then at a certain moment our human mind, our human abilities cease. And that's the dark night of the soul, and Mother Teresa experienced that for at least 34 years. which is extraordinary. All the big saints have experienced it for a year, at most, or 3 months. And she for 35 years. What that means for the quality of her sanctity, I don't know. But I expect some surprises.
Surprises, I imagine, which lead to the path towards her being declared a saint. But at this point, why don't we glimpse at some of the chapters in your book? For example, one which goes by the title, With the Poorest of the Poor. Correct me if I'm wrong, but for Mother Teresa, the poorest of the poor weren't just the needy in Calcutta, no?
Yes, she repeated often, you need not go to Calcutta to find the poorest of the poor. Look for them in your own family, find them, love them, and put your love for God into a living action for them. I believe that she has told us a lot about what Christ meant when he said, love one another as I have loved you. Because he loved us, that means you and me, exactly as we are. Not better, not worse, exactly as we are. He started loving us from the point where we are now, and he continues loving us wherever we get to. And Mother Teresa did that in an interesting twist with the Muslims and with the Hindu. She always treated them as complete equals. Because she said, if you are a Muslim, be a good Muslim, then you come closer to God. And if you come closer to God, he can do with you what he wants. If you're a Catholic, be a good Catholic, because that will get you closer to God and he can do with you what he wants. For her, it was important to get closer to God, not whether you're a Catholic, a Muslim, a Hindu, whatever. She was a Catholic 100% in her soul, in her actions, in her doing, in her teachings. But she said, everybody, one could say, approaches God from a different side. And what is important is to get closer to God, not to get stuck on the way, lose your way, you lose your orientation. Just touch Christ in the poorest of the poor. That was her missionary method.
You have a chapter in which you talk about pilgrims, prostitutes and politicians. That's a strange combination, isn't it?
Well, they have one thing in common. They are poor. Each one of them has a poverty of its own. The pilgrim is looking for the aim of his pilgrimage. The prostitutes are not happy in what they are doing. They know they are doing it because they are in need of something. And the politicians never reach their aim in any way. But she dealt with all of them in exactly the same way, exactly the same kind, loving, profound way. And I think that makes her very special, and it made her special to the prostitutes, to the politicians and to the pilgrims.
She was disarmingly charming in one story.
Disarmingly charming.
Can you be disarmingly charming?
Oh, yes, you can be disarmingly charming, because I could have gotten quite angry with her from time to time. I remember one incident in Zagreb when she sent me at 10 o'clock in the morning to change our ticket instead of going to Munich to Warsaw. So I had to queue for an hour. That was still under the communist time. And I queued for an hour. Then I came back with the change ticket. I said, Mother, here it is. She said, oh, Father, I'm so sorry, but you know, we do have got to Munich. Please, could you go back and change the ticket again? So I walked back and I came back for lunch, very, very sort of angry. And I met one of the sisters and I said, today I learned what MC stands for. She said, Father, you know for sure it stands for much confusion. No, not only for missions of charity, but for much confusion. Then I had to change the ticket a third time. We had to go to Warsaw. In the airplane at 6 o'clock in the evening, I was sitting next to Mother Teresa and said, Mother Teresa, today I learned what missions of charity MC really means, the abbreviation MC means. And she said, Father, what does it mean? And I said, well, it means much confusion. And she said, yes, Father, but you know, it also means more confusion, mental case. And so she gave me, I think, 8 more meanings for MC. And with that, with her charming way, she saved the day.
So you accompanied her on her travels. In the book, there are photographs of you both in the Soviet Union and Armenia, if I'm correct.
Mother Teresa started her first house in Moscow in 88. And her first house in Armenia at Christmas 89, right after the earthquake. And I spent half a year there with the sisters. And so I came to know what the poverty, the local poverty, meant to the sisters. Because the Mother Teresa always distinguished, maybe not rationally, but in her actions, between the 3 levels of poverty. Material poverty, which she found in Calcutta, India, and so on. Social poverty, which he found in the big capitals of the Western world, in New York, in Rome, in London. Loneliness, she said, loneliness is very, it's much more difficult to heal somebody from loneliness than to heal somebody from hunger, because you give him a piece of bread and he's not hungry anymore. But if somebody's lonely, it's much deeper. But then she came to the third level, which was spiritual poverty. If you don't know God, if you don't have the possibility to approach him, if you're not allowed to know about him. And that for her was the biggest poverty. And so she took the sisters to Moscow in 1988, precisely with the purpose to serve all three levels of poverty, material, spiritual, and social.
On the cover of your book, there's an autograph by Mother Teresa, which reads, "Dear Father Leo, be holy like Jesus. God bless you, Mother Teresa."
Well, she gave these little sentences to almost everybody, and she gave a great number to us, because she always wanted to give something. She wanted always to give you, to show her love in a way by giving something, whether these were material things or her autographs. And so I have a number of these autographs, but they are very deep. Be holy like Jesus. That's it. It's very simple.
The last chapter has a title, Mother Teresa Lives.
Mother Teresa is still alive. Yes, I think it was the late Cardinal Foley who said that Mother Teresa's beatification. He said, if you want to see Mother Teresa nowadays, look at the sisters, because they do what Mother Teresa did. And I believe that's true. If you look at the sisters around the world, you find that, one could say, genetic code of Mother Teresa in the sisters. The same patience, kindness, the same love for the poor, the same poverty, the same obedience. And I believe that's the big compliment to the sisters. If they live up to what Mother Teresa expected from them, then they will be similar to Mother Teresa.
And our thanks there go to Monsignor Leo Marsberg, currently National Director of the Pontifical Mission Societies in Austria. Finally, to end the programme on a lighter note, I'd like you to join our popular Latin lover as he speaks to us about the gods the Romans believed in. He's Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. Today I'd like to speak about Roman religion with you, Father. You know what I discovered is that the Romans were snobs in matter of religion.
Well, in general, if you were like the upper classes, you respected religion as a formality.
Yeah, but how'd you say snob?
And, I don't know. Contemptor.
Contemptor, in other words. Yeah,
contemptor, or a contemptor, one who looks down on other things. The people, the common people, as today in most religions, who are ignorant, follow kind of this crowd and follow this kind of faith. But the intelligentsia, well, they didn't have time.
Well, I read that there were gods for noble families like Jupiter.
Well, yeah, I mean, Caesar had Venus for his family. Oh, no, Caesar built his forum there near the, you know, Piazza Venezia, and there was a temple to Venus. And he said, my patron goddess somewhere, but is Venus. That whole story is told by Virgil. And so he built this temple to Venus.
How'd you say my patron goddess is Venus?
No, patrona dea mea, Venus. Venus was the patron goddess of the Caesar line, of the Caesar family.
Oh, Caesar.
For a thousand years.
But they're even snobbier than that, because they had the Romans, because they even had emperor gods.
But a little bit later.
That emperors, didn't... living or dead, were treated like gods.
Well, usually dead. The divus.
They're worshipped as gods. How do you say worship?
Well, you know, colebantur, excolebantur, adorabantur, There are all kinds of names. You can look in the Roman Forum there. You see Divus Antoninus Pius et Diva Faustina. Well, the Senate declared her a goddess, Diva, and then declared him a god, Divus Antoninus. But these are titles there.
So that's where the word diva from Hollywood.
Oh, for the Italians, yes. Oh, for sure. I mean, that's where they're at. Like a divine kind of a personage. Mm.
Divine actress.
And the fact is, we say today, St. Thomas Aquinas, which a lot of students don't understand, is Divus Thomas. Divine Thomas.
Do you like Thomas?
Oh, yeah, that's all right. He's all right.
How would you describe him in Latin?
Sapientissimus et clarissimus et, and in many other words.
Sapientissimus is
doctissimus et clarissimus et facilimus and easy and so forth and so on. What people did with Thomas is bad. That's the problem.
Why?
Not only they made a god out of him, but his intellectual processes became like some sort of a magic thing, which was not good. Like he would say, there are three reasons for this yellow pen here. You see? Got an idea? Mm. And there are four reasons for this green there. He had, in theology, he had all these different visions and reasons for things. Well, then some other people picked this up a little later, and it became so facile, got the idea, it became ridiculous. You could prove anything you want. The 40 bus is called the 40 bus because the number 40, then you start playing with the number 40 in Scripture. You see what I'm talking about?
At any rate,
let me get on this.
We went from speaking about gods to St. Thomas. The Romans had, like we have, for example, in English, O Father Thames. The Tiber was thought of as...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that they had, for sure.
The Tiber, which is Rome's river, was thought of as a person, right?
Yes, yes, yes. Father, Pater Tiberis.
How did they describe the Tiber in their writings, the Romans? They must have written about the Tiber.
Oh, a million times.
What, is there anything?
Well, this is like Virgil, for example, running smoothly with little eddies, little kind of little...
How do you say that?
Of water, you know, vertiginibus, cum vertigine. Or the Tiber River going multa flavus arena, yellow with much.
The sand was arena.
And then muddy would be lutosa or chenosa. There are different words for muddy.
So how would you say old Father Tiber?
Vetus Tiberis Pater.
Vetus meaning old.
Oh, yeah, certainly. Oh, Virgil talks in those terms. There's no problem there.
Carmelite Father Reginald Foster is currently teaching Latin in the United States, but was for many years and under many popes, papal Latinist. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.rv.va, and then click on the English World icon. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.